Welcome to History 101, Lecture 16, Liberator. One of the consequences of all the wealth flowing from the colonies to the metropolis was that colonial governments there pulled out needed to tighten their hold on the colonies. Colonies that had all been rather loosely controlled in the 16th and 17th centuries, partly because they had been conquered piecemeal, and the administrative setup reflected that piecemeal nature, partly too because they had been settled piecemeal, or finally because areas belonged to chartered companies which were jealously guarding their privileges. This was necessary both for the better defense of the colonies, which, as the Seven Years' War had shown, were all very vulnerable to attack, the British having, for example, briefly occupied Havana, or to forestall that smuggle and illegal trade that had become an entire way of life for many colonists, particularly in New England and in the Rio La Plata. So too, it was necessary to streamline revenue gathering in the colonies. For the costs of the Seven Years' War left most governments with a yawning deficit in their treasury. Yet there was also a feeling throughout metropolitan colonial administrations that the metropolis had to stem the abuses of the Indian natives, and that it had now to base the administration on sound scientific principles rather than on inherited rights. In the 1760s, the Bourbon kings of Spain thus started to effect a far-reaching administrative reform. First, the old administrative arrangement of dividing Spanish America into two huge viceroyalties was considered too cumbersome, so that two new viceroyalties were created, that of New Granada, based on Bogota, that would have jurisdiction over Venezuela and Colombia, and one on the Rio La Plata, that was based on Buenos Aires, and that had jurisdiction over Argentina, Uruguay, and Bolivia. The reforms also meant more administrators, and the Bourbons preferred important posts to be staffed by honest peninsulares, that is, people from Spain, rather than on local-born criollo, who were untrustworthy because they had far too many local ties. The cornerstone of their administrative reforms was to be the intendant sent over from Spain. An intendant had wide administrative and fiscal powers and was to curb local corruption, to encourage trade and industry, and to facilitate the honest collection of taxes. Because, as he was sent over from Spain, he would be an honest and impartial man, freed from all those corrupt practices that had defined all business in the Americas so far. So whereas office holders in Spanish America had so far purchased their positions, the intendant was to be a modern, salaried official who looked upon his office as a service to the king, or indeed to the public. Furthermore, the crown also replaced criollos by peninsulares in municipal councils, in courts of law, and in positions in the army. However, for the criollos and the Indian population, these reforms mainly boiled down to higher taxes, to more rigid enforcement tax laws, and to fewer possibilities for negotiating, or rather, for bribing local officials. And this caused widespread discontent. The British government was faced with very similar problems as that of Spain, with two differences. First, after the Seven Years' War, the area it now had to administer was even unwieldier than that of Spain. The government now had, for example, to reconcile the interests of Scotland with that of England, and Scotland wanted its share in imperial patronage and imperial trade. The Virginia planter, for example, complained that parliamentary patronage had raised Glasgow, quote, from a miserable little port to one of the richest in the world, all by fawning and flattering and outwitting the planters. There were the interests of the Irish landlords to consider as well, where, somewhat similar as in Scotland, by now potato-growing Catholic crofters were thrown off their best land to make place for cattle that was salted and then exported to the West Indies. There were the West Indian interests and those of the slave trade I dealt with before. And then there was the East India Company that had still heavy debts to government and needed to pay an ever-increasing army in India, so that it was hovering perilously close to bankruptcy. And then there were the North American colonies, where the British government had not merely to consider the interests of the colonists, but those of the Indians, of the Quebec Catholics, or those of the Hudson Bay Company as well. Yet, in the final instance, British Parliament always represented above all itself. That is a very narrow class interest. Only about 32,000 people in England had the right to vote, coupled to possessing landed property. That ranged from Westminster Borough, with its 9,000 voters, to famously that of Old Sarum, with only one voter, who not surprisingly always elected himself to Parliament, namely the Pitt family, who had become rich in the trade with India in the early 18th century. Of the 489 members of Parliament, 350 possessed manor, and the rest were overwhelmingly wealthy merchants. The second difference was that up to the 1760s, British policy towards the American colonies was marked by the so-called benign neglect. Long-reigning Prime Minister Horace Walpole left all affairs of the colonies to his colonial secretary, the Duke of Newcastle, whose noble peace of mind was not upset by colonial affairs. Newcastle knew nothing about them. Gossip had it that his cupboard was filled with colonial dispatches, none of which he had ever opened. Yet the North American colonists cheered all this. However, this also meant that steadily more power drifted to the colonial assemblies. Colonial assemblies that were by 18th century norms highly democratic. One had to have a freehold or 1,500 sterling value to vote in such an assembly. And those assemblies raised virtually all taxes in the colonies. even by the 1770s, King George III had as much power in the colonies in North America, it was said at the time, as he had in the wilds of Tartary. However, the dire financial situation Britain was in after the Seven Years' War forced the government now to act to obtain more money from the American colonies. After all, as we saw, British subjects were amongst Europe's most heavily taxed, while the colonists now paid virtually no tax. It would be difficult, Parliament said, to persuade dirt-poor cottagers in Britain who had to cough up all kinds of severe taxes, that the colonists, who were generally much better paid and much more affluent than them, were really unable to pay their own defense. Particularly as Britain still paid the national debt too, a national debt Britain had made, in a war that was, after all, largely fought to defend the American colonies, whilst the British, furthermore, complained that during that war, New England merchants had happily sold ammunition to the French or Spanish foe. Parliament at Westminster saw itself as the supreme lawmaking authority throughout the British possessions, and it was therefore entitled to levy tax without colonial approval. 4. Parliament perceived nothing in the unwritten British constitution that made taxes special. It furthermore insisted that the colonies effectively enjoyed a virtual representation, as they called it, as most British people did, as after all only a small minority of the British population elected representative to the Parliament. The colonists objected to all that, not because those taxes were high, but because they had no representation in Parliament. Their slogan became, "No taxation without representation." And they argued the colonies were new body politics, autonomous in regulating their internal affairs. Under the new administration of Prime Minister George Grenfell, Parliament thus enacted a series of acts to tighten up the administration of the colonies, of which the most controversial was the Stamp Act of 1765 that imposed direct taxes on the colonies for the first time. All official documents, newspapers, almanacs, wedding certificates, pamphlets, even decks of playing cards, were henceforth required to have a stamp to show that tax was paid on it. And, as this was a very visible tax, which everybody would have to pay, whether buying a newspaper or getting married, colonists from all walks of life were affected by it. Provincial assemblies refused to implement the Stamp Act, and did to protest against it. Associations called the Sons of Liberty were formed, mostly from the upper working class, shopkeepers, small merchants, or craftsmen, who all felt the impact of the act, and declared that the act was void, as violating their rights as Englishmen. When Parliament heard, it need not be obeyed. However, the colonists persisted in sending numerous petitions and pleas for intervention to the English monarch, to whom they claimed loyalty. They used public demonstrations, boycotts, violence, and threats of violence to ensure that the British tax laws were unenforceable. Several provincial legislatures called for united action, and 9 colonies sent delegates to the Stamp Act Congress in New York City in October 1765. In London, the Rockingham government came to power in July 1765, and Parliament debated whether to repeal the stamp tax or send an army to enforce it. Parliament finally decided to repeal the act in February, not so much due to colonial protests, as rather due to protests by English merchants who saw their sales in the colonies hampered by the actions there. However, in the Declaratory Act of March 1766, Parliament insisted that it retained full power to make laws for the colonies. The repeal of the Stamp Act, nonetheless, caused widespread celebrations in the colonies. In 1767, Parliament passed the Townshend Act that placed duties on a number of essential goods, including paper, glass, and tea, and it established a board of customs in Boston to more rigorously execute trade regulations. Those new taxes were enacted in the belief that Americans only objected to internal taxes and not to external ones like custom duties. The Americans, however, argued against the constitutionality of that act because its purpose was to raise revenue and not regulate trade. The colonists responded by organizing new boycotts of British goods. A new ministry under Lord North came to power in 1770, and Parliament withdrew all taxes except a tax on tea, giving up its effort to raise revenue while maintaining the right to tax. This temporarily resolved the crisis, and only a few more radical patriots, such as Samuel Adams, continued to agitate. In 1772, Adams, in Boston, set about creating a new committee of correspondence that linked patriots in all 13 colonies and eventually provided the framework for a rebel government. A total of about 7,000 patriots served on those committees of correspondence, and they became the leaders of American resistance to British actions and largely determined the war effort at the state and local level later on. When the First Continental Congress decided to boycott British products, the colonial and local committees took charge. They examined merchant records, and they would publish names of merchants who attempted to defy a boycott by importing British goods. Meanwhile, Parliament passed the Tea Act, who lowered the price of taxed tea exported to the colonies in order to help the East India Company undersell smuggled Dutch tea. Special consignees were appointed to sell the tea in order to bypass colonial merchants. The act was opposed not only by those who resisted the taxes, but also by most merchants who stood to lose business by it. In most cases, the consignees were forced to resign and the tea turned back. But Massachusetts Governor Hutchinson refused to give in to such pressure. A town meeting in Boston determined that the deep would not be landed, and it ignored a demand from the governor to disperse. On December 16, 1773, a group of men, led by Adams, dressed like American Indians, boarded the ships of the British East India Company, and they dumped 10,000 sterling worth tea into Boston Harbor. Decades later, this event became known as the Boston Tea Party, and it remains a very significant part of American lore. London decided steps had to be taken to secure the dependence of the colonies, mark out Boston, and single out that town from the rest. Parliament passed four laws that came to be known as the Intolerable Acts. They altered Massachusetts Charter. They restricted town meetings there. They closed the port of Boston until the British had been compensated for the tea lost in the Boston Tea Party. And they allowed royal governors to house British troops in the House of Citizens without requiring permission of the owner. In response, Massachusetts patriots formed an alternative shadow government known as the Provincial Congress, which began training militia outside of British-occupied Boston. The Massachusetts Committee of Correspondence called for an immediate boycott of British goods, but the other provinces wanted to call a Continental Congress to deliberate on what line to follow, that convened in Philadelphia. It consisted of representatives from each state, except Georgia. It blasted the Intolerable Acts as a gross infraction of those rights we are justly entitled to by the laws of nature, by the British East Constitution, and by the charters of the provinces. The law should therefore be rejected as coming from a wicked administration that seeks to enslave America. While the Continental Congress called on everybody qualified to learn the art of war as soon as possible and appear under arms once every week. It also passed non-import, non-export, and non-consumption resolutions, and to enforce the ban on trade, it set up committees of safety and committees of observation, a revolutionary deed, as Americans were now vesting sovereignty in themselves rather than in Parliament. Massachusetts was declared in state of rebellion in February 1775, and the British garrison received orders to disarm the rebels and arrest their leaders, leading to a fight in Lexington on 19 April 1775, the shot heard around the world. The Patriots set siege to Boston, expelled royal officials from all colonies, and took control through the establishment of provincial Congresses. Yet Congress was still reluctant to declare independence. It sent a petition that begged the King of England to resolve the conflict with Parliament. But the King proclaimed the colonies were in open and avowed rebellion instead. In all 13 colonies, patriots had meanwhile overthrown existing governments, had closed ports, and had driven British officials away. They had instead elected conventions and legislatures that existed outside of any old legal framework. New provincial constitutions were drawn up to supersede royal charters. The provinces declared they were states now, no longer colonies. In March 1767, with George Washington, a dignified Virginia planter, as the commander of the new army, the new Continental Army forced the British to evacuate Boston. The revolutionaries were now in full control of 13 colonies. There were, to be sure, still many royalists clinging to the cause of the British king, but they were no longer in control anywhere. By July 1776, all royal officials had fled. The British, however, were massing forces at Halifax, Nova Scotia. By June, 9 colonies were ready for independence. One by one, the last 4 remaining, Pennsylvania, Delaware, Maryland, and New York, finally fell into line. After securing enough votes for passage, independence was proclaimed on July the 2nd. The Declaration of Independence, drafted largely by Thomas Jefferson, was unanimously adopted by Congress on July the 4th. It marked the foundation of a new state that called itself the United States of America. And on the preamble of that Declaration of Independence, we hold these rights to be self-evident. The Scotsman at the time merely observed, quote, "The opinions of the Americans on government, like those of their ancestors on witchcraft, would be too ridiculous to desert notion if, like them too, contemptible and extravagant as they are, they might not have nefarious consequences." Historians estimate that about 40% of the white population in the 13 colonies supported the cause of the revolution. 15% were loyalists and remained neutral. The revolutionaries were called Patriots, Whigs, or Americans. They included a wide range of social and economic classes, but they were all unanimous regarding the need to defend the right of the Americans and uphold the principles of republicanism while rejecting monarchy and aristocracy and emphasizing civic virtue on the part of the citizens. The ones who actively supported the king were known as loyalists or Tories. Loyalists thought that the crown and the parliament had perfectly good reasons for taxing the colonies. Surely, things were not as they should be. But did that justify rebellion? Typically, loyalists were older, less willing to break with old loyalties. They were often linked to the Church of England, and they included many merchants with business ties across the British Empire. In 1776, the colonies were possessed by what one historian has called a rage for arms, as colonists enthusiastically enlisted in the colonial militias, and everybody was then convinced that, quote, "Our troops are animated by the love of freedom. They have no experience and discipline, but our native courage and patriotism are more than sufficient to counterbalance all of this." Everybody was certain of that, except Washington, who described his own army as a mixed multitude under very little discipline or government. Worse, as the Congress paid the war with bills that had little or no backing, the scant pay soldiers caught in the Continental Army, half the salary of a laborer, was superfluous in a very short time. The plain fact about the Continental Army was that, rather than consisting of the brave patriots of legend, it was just like any army at the time. It overwhelmingly consisted of very poor men, who were mainly busy with where their food was to come from, and patriotism or liberty was mostly distant from their mind. Though smaller in number, the British had some advantages over the colonists. They had a centralized administration, they had an efficient system of public finance, and above all, they had a navy. yet service overseas was extremely unpopular, and to meet the demand for 50,000 men needed to stem the American revolt, the government had on the one hand to lend the armed forces of German princelings, who would gladly sell their own subjects to adore their mistresses with diamonds, the so-called Hessians. They made up half the British army. On the other hand, the government drained English jails and poorhouses of able-bodied men. So the attrition of the British army, by constant desertion as much as by disease, was atrocious. In addition, the standard battle tactics of European armies were excellently fitted for the open fields of Europe, but they were completely unfitted for the forests or swamps of North America. But the British were above all handicapped by their misunderstanding of the depth of support for the patriots. They thought the American Revolution was merely the work of a few misguided elements who had rallied an armed rebel to their cause, and they expected that the revolutionaries would be intimidated soon enough, and then the vast majority of Americans, who were loyal to the crown but cowed by their terrorist tactics, would rise up, kick them out, and restore loyal government in the colonies. So the British returned to North America in force in July 1776, landing in New York and defeating Washington's army at the Battle of Brooklyn in August. The British then quickly seized New York City and nearly captured Washington's army. They made New York to their main political and military base of operations, holding it until November 1783, and it became the haven for loyalist refugees. The British also took New Jersey, pushed the Continental Army into Pennsylvania, but in a surprise attack in late December 1776, Washington crossed the Delaware River back into New Jersey, and he defeated the British armies at Trenton and Princeton. Thereby, he regained control of most of New Jersey. Those victories gave an important boost to the patriotic cause at a time when the morale was flagging, and they have of course become the iconic events of the war. In 1777, as part of a grand strategy to end the war, the British sent an invasion force from Canada to seal off New England, which the British perceived as the prime source of agitators. In a major case of miscommunication, the British army in New York, that was to join the army coming in from Canada, went to Philadelphia instead. The invasion army, the Burgoyne, waited in vain for reinforcements from New York, and it became trapped in northern New York State, so that it finally was forced to surrender at the Battle of Saratoga in October 1777. The capture of a British army at Saratoga now encouraged the French government to formally enter the war in support of Congress. Benjamin Franklin negotiated a permanent military alliance in 1778. Later on, Spain in 1779 and the Netherlands in 1780 also declared war on Britain, so that the British Empire had now to fight a global war without allies that required it to slip through a combined blockade of the Atlantic, and that briefly threatened even an invasion of the British Islands. The American theater became merely one front in Britain's war. They were forced to withdraw troops from continental America to reinforce the sugar-producing Caribbean colonies, which were far more important than North America, as I said before, or to defend Gibraltar, that they did manage to hold against the Spanish siege. Due to the alliance with France and the deteriorating military situation, Henry Clinton, the British commander in North America, evacuated Philadelphia to reinforce New York City. Further British strategy in America now fostered on a campaign in the southern states. The South was perceived as being more loyalist, with a large population of recent British immigrants and large numbers of slaves who might run away to join the British. Beginning in late December 1778, the British captured Savannah and controlled the Georgia coastline. In 1780, they launched a fresh invasion and took Charleston as well. The British set up a network of forts inland, hoping loyalists would rally to their cause. Not enough turned up, however, and the British had eventually to fight their way north to North Carolina and Virginia with a weakened army behind them. Much of the territory they had already captured dissolved into chaotic guerrilla war. The British army under Cornwallis marched to Yorktown, Virginia, where they expected to be rescued by the British fleet. That fleet showed up, but a much larger French fleet also did. So the British fleet returned to New York, and Cornwallis was trapped at Yorktown Peninsula. In October 1781, under combined siege by the French and Continental Army under Washington, the British surrendered their invading army to the Americans. Washington would not know that after Yorktown, the British would not reopen hostilities. They still had 26,000 troops that occupied New York City, Charleston, and Savannah. The French army and navy departed to the Caribbean, and the Americans were left on their own. Their treasury was empty, and the unpaid soldiers were growing restive, almost to the point of mutiny. The unrest among the soldiers, officially known as the Newburgh Conspiracy, was however personally dispelled by Washington, and Congress subsequently promised a 5-year bonus for all officers. The final peace treaty with Britain, known as the Treaty of Paris, gave the USA all land east of the Mississippi River and south of the Great Lakes, though not including Florida. It was afterwards said that the British offered exceptionally generous terms to the Americans in order that they could offer far less generous terms to the French, to the Spaniards, and to the Dutch, who were actually the big losers of this war. So that England, as it was said at the time, created a new world to balance the old. The Abbé Raynal, the writer of the Under the Counter book I discussed in an earlier lecture, after the peace concluded, that France had admittedly succeeded in this war in humiliating its old enemy, but that it had cost her a lot with very little gain. For, after all, though the French had now gotten a few trading posts in India back, what would all that matter if the English now possessed kingdoms there that were much richer than North America? And as to the French, Spanish, and Portuguese possessions they found themselves on so much now, he wrote, quote, "The new hemisphere must be detached from the old. This split is prepared in Europe by our being deprived of our rights, by the luxury of our court, and the misery of our countries, but above all by the hatred, the endless hatred, between the man without honor who possesses all possessions and the virtuous man who possesses absolutely nothing, and who have nothing but life to lose." and this split is prepared in America by the increase in cultivation, in industry and in knowledge there. For France, by far the most important colony in the Americas, was Saint-Domingue. That island produced 60% of the world's coffee and 40% of the world's sugar. By far the most profitable possession of the French Empire. Indeed, arguably by 1790, the most valuable piece of territory anywhere in the world, including even Bengal. In 1789, whites in Saint-Domingue numbered 32,000. Yet the white society was, wrote Renan, a very strange society, one where every man is only in a hurry to get rich, to quit a situation where there are few honors and few pleasures to be found. No one lives in Saint-Domingue with an intention of living and dying. All their views are fixed on Europe, and they consist of the expectation of returning to our hemisphere as soon as possible. The richest in Saint-Domingue, the sugar planters of the Grand Blanc, were chiefly minor aristocrats. The lower class-wise, the Petit Blanc, were shopkeepers, artisans, slave dealers, overseers of slaves, and day laborers. Then there were Saint-Domingue's free people of color, gens de couleur, who numbered about 28,000 in 1789. Yet they were pestered by the colonial legislation. It, on the one hand, imposed military duty on them, yet they were still prohibited to wear the same clothes as white people, prohibited to become military officers, or prohibited to obtain any public office. Many of the gens de couleur were artisans and overseers, or they might be domestic servants in big houses. And finally, there were the slaves, an estimated 500,000. 2/3 of them were African-born. For some 30,000 people were annually imported from all over Africa. On a typical sugar estate, there might be 20 different African languages spoken. Some of these slaves, too, were Creole. That is to say, they were born in Saint-Domingue, and they tended to be a bit more affluent than the Africans. They typically worked as domestics, as slave drivers, or artisans. Toussaint Louverture was a Creole, while Dessalines was an African. That underclass, born in Africa, labored hard, mostly under brutal conditions. The news of the fall of the Bastille and the creation of a national assembly in France in the summer of 1789 was enthusiastically received in Saint-Domingue. The poor whites all adopted the revolutionary cockade, and they riotously celebrated the French Revolution. The rich planters, on the other hand, organized themselves in an assembly, and they adopted a constitution in 1790 that severely restricted French control over Saint-Domingue. Some even talked about following the American example. They all agreed on two things: white supremacy, and slavery should be maintained under all circumstances. And yet, the Estates General of France had published a Declaration of the Rights of Man, declaring all men free and all men equal. And this became a source of inspiration for the gens de couleur. Were they not men? Were they not taxpayers? Saint-Domingue's gens de couleur, most notably the wealthiest of those free people, Julien Raymond, had been actively appealing in France for civil equality since the 1780s. In October 1790, Vincent Auguet, another wealthy man of color, returned home from France to Saint-Domingue, where he had been working with Raymond. Only a show of force by the gens de couleur, he decided, could press the issue. Yet Auguet was no good as an insurrectionary. On the way to Saint-Domingue, he had foolishly discussed discussed his plan for a revolt with the French consul at Charleston, so the government was already prepared when he arrived. He was taken prisoner and brutally executed by being broken on the wheel and then being beheaded. That news of Auger's brutal execution shocked the National Assembly in Paris, and it decided to grant citizenship to free wealthy people of color in 1791. This news, however, provoked a violent backlash in Saint-Domingue, since the white plantation owners refused to comply with this new law from Paris. And when the French governor announced he would implement this law anyway, they began to arm themselves to resist it, and isolated fighting broke out. And then, on the historic night of 22 August 1791, completely unexpectedly, the slaves of Saint-Domingue rose in the revolt they had been planning for in deep secret for many months already. As obviously as their masters were now so internally divided, this would be the ideal moment for it. Toussaint Louverture, who is shown in the picture of this nature, who, as he was freed, could freely circulate, served as courier between resistance cells on several plantations. The signal to begin the revolt was given by Duty Boekman, a high priest of Voodoo, or Ayuju, as he has a common Fanti name, during a religious ceremony at Bois Caimont, where he pronounced the following historic prayer. God, who makes the sun which gives us light, he sees all what the whites are doing. The God of the white orders crime, but our God asks us to avenge our wrongs. Throw away the symbols of the God of the whites, who has so often made us weep. Listen to the voice of liberty, which speaks in the hearts of all. Within the next 10 days, slaves had taken control of the entire northern province in an unprecedented revolt. Whites were now in control of only a few isolated, fortified camps. As the plantation owners had long feared just such a revolt, they were very well armed and they were well prepared to defend themselves. Yet nothing, not even grapeshot of cannons, appeared to be able to stem the tide of the revolt, and within weeks the numbers of slaves who had joined it had reached some 100,000. Within the next 2 months they killed some 4,000 whites and they burned or destroyed 180 sugar plantations, and so practically the whole island appeared to be on fire. By 1792, slave rebels controlled a third of the island. The Legislative Assembly in France realized it was facing an emergency, and it dispatched 6,000 French soldiers to the island under Commissioner Léger Félicité Sontenax, an energetic member of the Friends of the People Society of the Jacobin Club. And he had previously written, "Let the governments of Europe resist the cries of liberty and universal justice. Yet the day shall come when an African, with his curly hair and no other recommendation but his good senses, shall sit in our National Assembly." In 1793, France declared war on Great Britain. The white planters, who for obvious reasons detested Sontenax, now made an agreement with Great Britain they would hand over the island to the British. Spain, that controlled the rest of the island of Hispaniola, joined the conflict. Spanish forces invaded Saint-Domingue and were joined by the slave forces. For most of the next few months, the Spaniards supplied the slave rebels with food, ammunition, and arms. By August 1793, there were merely 3,000 French soldiers on the island left. To prevent a military disaster, Commissioner Sontenax now decided he would free all slaves in San Domingue. A delegation from San Domingue pleaded these laws should be implemented by the National Convention in France as well. And on the 4th of February 1794, under the leadership of Maximilien Robespierre, the French National Convention declared that slavery is hereby abolished in all French colonies. All men, without distinction of color, are hereby the citizens of the French Republic. The most successful black commander was Toussaint Louverture. After the British had invaded San Domingue, Louverture decided to fight for the French if they would agree to free all the slaves. Louverture abandoned the Spanish army in the east and he brought his forces over to the French side. The British government panicked. With the unprecedented system adopted by the enemy for overturning all regular government and all subordination, as they called it, they now sent an army of 30,000 men to the Caribbean. The British force was, however, gradually whittled down by tropical diseases and they had to be withdrawn in 1798. The campaign in the Caribbean cost the British army 70,000 lives, more than the War of American Independence or Waterloo, although admittedly 95% of it was to disease. So Toussaint, after he had repulsed the British, essentially restored control of Saint Domingue to France. He addressed letters to Napoleon as the first of the blacks to the first of the whites. And though this made Napoleon furious, he was actually stating a fact. Having made himself master of the island, Toussaint did not wish to surrender too much power to France. He began to rule the country as an autonomous entity, and in 1801 issued a constitution for Saint Domingue that he had notably written himself, and that was far more progressive than any constitution ever adopted by the French Republic during the Revolution. Napoleon Bonaparte reacted furiously, saying, "Toussaint is a revolted slave. We must punish him. The honor of France is at stake." So Napoleon dispatched an expeditionary force of 40,000 French soldiers, led by his brother-in-law, Charles Leclerc, who was accompanied by his wife, Napoleon's sister, Pauline, who at high speed consumed lovers whilst her husband was off fighting. Looking back on his life from the island of St. Helena, Napoleon afterwards claimed that sending that expedition was by far the most stupid decision of his entire life. However, he claimed he had been persuaded by his wife Josephine, who was, after all, from a slave-owning family from Guadeloupe. The expedition was under secret orders to restore slavery. After severe resistance, Louverture and his lieutenant Jean-Jacques de Saline surrendered, and they promised to integrate the remaining troops into the French army. However, Toussaint Louverture was later betrayed, was taken prisoner, and shipped to France. He perished a few months later in a dungeon in Fort de Joux in the Jura region. And yet, Toussaint Louverture had, as he was shipped away, assured the French, "Overthrowing me, you have cut the trunk of black liberty for the time being, yet it will grow again, as it has deep roots." For a few months, the island was quiet on the French rule. But as it became apparent that they intended to re-establish slavery, as Napoleon had in 1802 revoked the decree of the National Assembly that abolished slavery, black cultivators revolted in the summer. Dessalines initially remained allied to the French, but he switched sides in October 1802. In November, Leclerc died of yellow fever, just like much of his army. The towns of Saint-Domingue turned to charnel houses. His successor, the Vicomte de Rochambeau, fought up the brutal campaign. He has the dubious distinction of being the inventor of the gas chamber, to gas people with sulfur, as hanging people or having them torn apart by dogs was too time-consuming. His atrocities helped rally many former French loyalists to the rebel cause. Dessalines led the rebellion until the French forces were finally defeated at the Battle of Ferrières near Cap Haïtien on 18 November 1803, and they surrendered. In January 1804, from the city of Gonaïves, Dessalines declared the former colony's independence, and he renamed it Haiti after the old Arawak name. Haiti's achievement was monumental. It was the first independent nation in Latin America, and later on, it would support the struggle of independence there too, with weapons and with funds. It was the first post-colonial, independent, black-led nation in the world, and it was the only nation ever whose independence was gained after a successful slave rebellion. Yet the country was crippled by years of war. Its agriculture was devastated, and its formal commerce was as good as non-existent, and no Western country would recognize its independence, until France finally did so in 1834, which Haiti, however, had to pay France compensation that would cripple its economy for decades. The United States would not recognize Haiti until after the Civil War, but after the Civil War, the US Marine Corps developed a high degree of interest in Haiti that has arguably crippled Haiti even more. The Peninsular War, as the British call it, or the War of Independence or of Liberation, as the Spaniards call it, was the trigger for the independence of Latin America. It is a complicated and convoluted story, as it is the point where the one history of colonial America fragments into that of 16 different countries, which all have their distant historiographies, mostly fostered on the respective heroes of the nation. Napoleon's removal of the Bourbon dynasty from the Spanish throne precipitated a general crisis in Spain that began with the famous uprising of the 2nd of May in Madrid in 1808. Then the whole country rose up against the French. Although everybody rejected Napoleon's plan to give the crown to his brother Joseph, there was no clear solution to the lack of a king. The provinces of the Iberian Peninsula responded to the crisis by establishing provincial councils, juntas. That, however, led to utter confusion, as the central authorities in Madrid still tended to collaborate with Napoleon, and the various provincial juntas spent most of their time bickering amongst themselves. This impasse was finally resolved through lengthy negotiations between the juntas, which finally created a supreme central and government junta of Spain and of the Indies, the cabinet. On 25 September 1808, it was agreed that the traditional kingdoms of the peninsula would send two representatives each to the central junta, which was to make a new Spanish constitution, while the overseas kingdoms, in the leonable parts of the monarchy, would send one representative. Those kingdoms were defined as the viceroyalties of La Plata, Argentina, Paraguay, Uruguay, and Ecuador, New Spain, Mexico, Peru, Bolivia and Peru, New Granada, Colombia and Ecuador, and the captaincy generals of the islands of Cuba, of Puerto Rico, of Guatemala and the other Middle American states, of Chile, of Venezuela and of the Philippines. At the end of 1808 and 1809, provincial capitals elected candidates to the juntas, whose names were forwarded to the capitals of the viceroyalties or the captaincy generals. However, an attempt at establishing a junta in Mexico was stopped by its viceroy. The dissolution of the Supreme Junta on that east, because of reverses suffered by the Spanish army at the Battle of Ocaña, set off a new wave of juntas being established in the Americas. Many saw no reason to recognize a mere rump government that at any moment could be captured by the French. So they began to work for the creation of local juntas to preserve the region's independence from the French. This set the stage for the fighting that would plague the region for the next two decades. Political fault lines appeared between broadly three groups. The conservative monarchists, who believed that the colonies were not only subject to the Spanish king, but to the Spanish traditional authorities as well, what they broadly called autonomists, who believed that though the colonies were subject to the king, this did not mean they were subject to his subordinate authorities, and a radical group which wanted to make the colonies independent. The proponents of independence called themselves patriots. The movements to independence were successful in New Granada and in Venezuela, that in 1811 declared itself independent under the leadership of Simón Bolívar. But Venezuela fell back under Spanish control a year later. Buenos Aires, however, that declared itself to the United Provinces of the Rio de la Plata in 1810, would not fall back under Spanish control. It was simply too remote. However, Buenos Aires would still have conquered the rest of the La Plata viceroyalty after that declaration, for the wealthy merchants of Buenos Aires were hated throughout the region, in Paraguay, in Uruguay, in Bolivia, then called Upper Peru, and even in southern Brazil. So the junta at Buenos Aires delivered an ultimatum to the governor and to the bishop at Asunción that they either were to join the United Provinces of the Rio de la Plata or face the consequences. However, the troops from Buenos Aires, under the command of General Manuel Belgrano, were utterly defeated by the Paraguayan loyalists in 1811. Yet these very defeats of the Argentinians strengthened local consciousness, besides of which everybody was afraid the Spanish governor was plotting to subject Paraguay to Brazil. In May 1811, therefore, there was a military coup in Asunción, in which the Spanish governor was deposed. A legislative junta was named, that in October 1813 declared Paraguay independent. However, wrote a Paraguayan historian later on about it, this independence was inexplicably neither officially declared, nor confirmed, nor sworn in, nor even ever communicated to the outside world, so that for decades nobody knew that Paraguay was an independent country. Admittedly, 1813, so eventful a year that few people outside of Paraguay probably would have cared. Provincial rivalries also led some regions to adopt the opposite political course to that chosen by their rivals. Although Simón Bolívar thought all Peruvians were stupid bumpkins, and that was the main reason, Peru remained strongly attached to the Spanish crown, in part because of its traditional rivalry with the Rio de la Plata, to which it had, after all, lost control of Upper Peru. the independence of Rio de la Plata allowed Peru to retain control of Bolivia again for the duration of the war. Besides regional, there were class and racial tensions as well. In Mexico, effort to establish an independent government took the form of a popular rebellion under the leadership of the priest Miguel Hidalgo Castillo in the Guanajuato province. Hidalgo was captured and shot in 1811, but the widespread guerrilla movement continued after his death. By 1815, the general outline of areas which were controlled by royalists and areas controlled by independent forces was established, and there was a kind of general stalemate. In areas where royalists controlled the main population center, most of the fighting done by those seeking independence was done by isolated guerrilleros bands. Royalist forces made advances into New Granada and into Chile. Except for royalist areas in the north, east and the south, the province of New Granada had maintained independence from Spain since 1811, unlike neighboring Venezuela, where royalists and pro-independence forces exchanged control of the region several times. To pacify Venezuela and to retake New Granada, Spain sent in 1815 the largest armed force it had ever sent to the New World, consisting of 10,500 troops under Pablo Murillo y Murillo, El Pacificador. Although this force was crucial in retaking New Granada, his soldiers were eventually spread out, much too thin, throughout Venezuela, New Granada, Quito, and Peru, and they were lost to tropical diseases that diluted their impact on the line. In March 1814, following the collapse of Napoleon's empire, Ferdinand VII, King of Spain, was restored to the throne, and almost all the political and legal changes made on both sides of the Atlantic, the myriads of juntas, the Cortes in Spain, and several of the congresses in the Americas, many of the constitutions and many new legal codes had been made in his name. Before entering Spanish territory, Ferdinand made loose promises to Cortes that he would uphold the Spanish constitution. However, once in Spain, he realized he had significant support from conservatives and from the hierarchy of the Spanish Catholic Church. So on 4 March, he repudiated the constitution and ordered the arrest of all liberal leaders. Ferdinand's actions brought about a definite break with the autonomous governments that had not yet declared independence and with efforts of Spanish liberals to create a representative government that would include the overseas possessions. Such a government was seen as an alternative to independence by many in New Spain, Central America, the Caribbean, in Quito, in Peru, in Upper Peru, and in Chile. Towards the end of the period, the pro-independent forces made two important advances. In the Rio de la Plata, a veteran of the Spanish army, with experiences in the Spanish War, José de San Martín, became governor of the province of Cuyo. He used his position to begin organizing his own army in preparation for an invasion of Chile. In January 1817, San Martín was ready to advance against the royalists in Chile. He led the army over the Andes. By 10 February, he had control of northern and central Chile, and a year later, after a war with no quarters, the south. With the aid of a fleet under the command of former British naval officer Thomas Cochrane, Chile was secured from royalist control, and independence was declared that year. San Martin and his allies spent the next 2 years preparing an invasion of Peru that would begin in 1820. For as long as Peru remained his loyalist stronghold, San Martin wrote, everything else would still go to the devil. In northern South America, after several failed campaigns to take Caracas and the other urban centers in Venezuela, Simón Bolívar devised a plan in 1819 to cross the Andes and liberate New Granada from royalists. From June to July 1819, using the rainy season as cover. Bolivar led his army across the jungles, across the floodplains, and then over the forbidding, frozen passes of the Andes, at 5,000 meter altitude, with heavy losses, from hunger as much as from altitude sickness, without the army faltering for one moment. It was surely enough to make him hero. But his gamble paid off. By August, Bolivar was in control of Bogota. With the resources of New Granada, Bolivar became the undisputed leader of the Patriots in Venezuela, and he orchestrated a temporary union of New Granada and Venezuela in a new state he called Colombia. To counter the advances of the pro-independence forces, Payne prepared a second and larger expeditionary force in 1819. That force, however, never left Spain. On the 1st of January 1820, Rafael del Riego, commander of the Asturias battalion, made a roundabout, demanded the return of 1812 Spanish constitution and marched to Madrid. And in March, the besieged King Ferdinand VII, now a prisoner, agreed to restore the constitution. However, he also secretly besieged his Bourbon family in France to intervene in order to get the constitution abolished again, which France eventually did in 1823. Riego's revolt had two effects in the Americas. Militarily, the large number of reinforcements needed to retake New Granada and defend the Viceroyalty of Peru would never arrive. Politically, the reinstitution of a liberal regime changed the terms under which the Spanish government sought to engage the insurgents. The new government assumed that those insurgents were fighting for Spanish liberalism, and that the Spanish constitution might be the basis for a reconciliation of the two sides. It was all enthusiastically welcomed in New Spain and in Central America. Elections were held in Mexico, local governments formed, and deputies were sent to the Cortes. Among liberals, however, there was fear that this new regime might not last, and conservatives and church worried a new liberal government would expand reforms and anti-clerical legislation. This climate of instability created the conditions for the two sides to forge an alliance that coalesced behind Agustín Iturbide, colonel of the Royal Army, who was assigned to destroy the remaining guerrilla forces which were led by Vicente Guerrero. In January 1821, Iturbide began peace negotiations with Guerrero. He suggested they unite to establish an independent new Spain. The terms that Iturbide proposed became the basis to the plan of Iguala, the independence of New Spain, now to be called the Mexican Empire, with Ferdinand VII or another Bourbon as emperor, the retention of the Catholic Church, and the protection of its existing privileges and equality of all New Spaniards, whether immigrants or native-born. The representative of the new Spanish government, Juan O'Donoghue, arrived in Veracruz on the 1st of July. Since at the time O'Donoghue had left Spain, the Cortes was considering greatly expanding the autonomy of overseas Spanish possessions, O'Donoghue proposed to negotiate a treaty with Iturbide. The resulting Treaty of Cordoba, signed on 24 August, kept all existing laws in force. However, the Spanish Cortes and Ferdinand VII rejected that Treaty of Cordoba, and the final break with Spain came on 19 May 1822, when the Mexican Congress conferred the throne on Iturbide. On 7 September 1820, meanwhile, San Martin's army had landed at Paracas and successfully took Pisco. After this, San Martin, awaiting a general Peruvian revolt, chose to avoid a further military confrontation. But the army sailed in late October to a better strategic position in Huacho, northern Peru. During the next few months, successful land and naval campaigns against the royalists secured that new foothold. And it was at Huacho that San Martin learned that Guayaquil, Ecuador, had declared independence on 9 October. Bolivar, learning about developments in Spain, spent the year 820 preparing a campaign to Venezuela. Although he rejected the Spanish proposal that the Patriots rejoin Spain under the new Spanish constitution, the two sides did establish a six-month truce. That truce, however, did not last. It was apparent to all that the royalist cause had been greatly weakened by the lack of reinforcements from Spain. Royalist soldiers and whole units began to desert the defect of the Patriots. The fate of Venezuela was sealed when Bolivar returned there in April, leading an army of 7,000 from New Granada. At the Battle of Carabobo in June, the Colombian forces decisively defeated the royalist ones. That assured control of Venezuela and guaranteed Venezuelan independence. In Peru, meanwhile, Viceroy Pezuela was deposed in a coup d'etat by Colonel José de la Serna, but it would be 2 months before San Martin moved his army closer to Lima by sailing to Angol. By July, La Serna judged his hold on Lima to be weak and abandoned the coastal city in order to reinforce his position in the highlands with Cusco as new capital of the viceroyalty. On the 12th of July, San Martin entered Lima, where he was declared protector of the country, an office that allowed him to rule the newly independent state. Bolivar sent aid in the form of an army under Antonio José de Sucre to Guayaquil in February 821. The following year, at the Battle of Pichincha, Sucre's Venezuelan force conquered Quito. Following year, after a Peruvian army was destroyed in the Battle of Ica, San Martin met Simon Bolivar in Guayaquil on the 26th of July and then faded into obscurity. For the next 2 years, two armies against Argentinian, Chilean, Colombian and Peruvian patriots were destroyed, trying to penetrate the royalist bastion in the Andean region, Peru and Upper Peru. An internecine conflict between La Serna and General Pedro Antonio Olañeta proved to be the royalist's undoing. La Serna lost control of half his best army by the beginning of 1824, giving the patriots their opportunity. Under the command of Bolivar and Sucre, the experienced veterans of the combined army, mainly Colombians, met a royalist army under La Serna's command in the final battle of the Latin American Wars of Independence at Ayacucho on 9 December 1824. Bolivar tended to favor maintaining the unity of Upper Peru with Peru, but Upper Peruvian leaders, gathered in a congress under Sucre's auspices, supported the country's independence. Bolivar left the decision to Sucre, who went along with the congress. Sucre proclaimed Upper Peru's independence in the city which now bears his name on 6 August, bringing the Wars of Independence to an end. And so the Americans, Canada, and the remaining British, French, and Dutch colonies in the Caribbean accepted, and the three remaining Spanish colonies, Cuba, Puerto Rico, and the Philippines accepted, had turned from colonial empires into a group of independent countries. Independent countries that shared far more with one another than either Latin American or Anglo-Americans commonly recognize. Brazil, and briefly Haiti and Mexico accepted, they were all republics, unlike, for example, the newly independent states of Europe in the Balkans, which all hastily had to be brought under some crowned head to gather international recognition. The Americas showed that a constitutional republic was in the long run a viable mode of government. The American countries all believed in written constitutions, whether forever sanctified in a near holy document, as in the United States, or repeatedly rewritten, as was common in Latin America. They all believed in popular sovereignty and in elections. They all believed in progress, and they all believed in technology. They were all secular states, and all believed religion was more or less a private matter. And last, but not least, they were all, though perhaps Haiti least, as there was hardly any group there which would qualify as such, and Brazil tried to recreate a nobility, they were still mainly bourgeois states, ruled by middle businessmen, of lawyers or of planters, rather than by nobility. In other words, not just the United States, but the whole of the Americas had become an empire of liberty. Yet U.S. congressmen were almost from the very outset confident of the future. They were laying the foundations to a great empire of the future, an empire that would compete with the British in time. However, the South Americans, far less certain, for, in polyphyletic, are we capable of maintaining in proper balance the difficult charge of a republic? Is it conceivable that a newly emancipated people can soar to the heights of liberty and, unlike Icarus, neither have its wings melt nor fall into an abyss? Such a marvel is inconceivable and without precedent. There is no reasonable probability to bolster our hopes.